We're obsessed about thinking about how do we spread this around the world? How do we get this out to a global market? We are targeting to reinvent a multi-billion dollar space.
What was the best part of working for Arctic Securities back when?
I think that was understanding the balance between the numbers and the opportunity in the company. That's when you can build multi-billion dollar companies.
It's genius.
He is an Arctic alumni. He is most of the time in Silicon Valley area, but he's back in Norway for a summer holiday, I believe. And he is also proudly announcing these days a Series B financing round. $39 million is the number. He is a tech executive, but I'm not sure about his technical education level. We'll get into that. He is, like I said, back in the house where some of his career started. So welcome, Magnus Hilstad. Very nice to see you back in the Arctic offices.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Sanity, because you are the CEO and co-founder of Sanity.io. And then I give you a very sort of brief, you need to give me the elevator pitch. What's the elevator pitch for Sanity?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. The elevator pitch for Sanity is that we're a platform for structured content. We're enabling companies to build better product and digital experiences by helping them serve content from a single source of truth to any application or device. And you could say, what does that really mean?
Yeah, I think we lost sort of half of the listeners here. We have many different listeners, but a lot of them, I would say, are maybe finance people. And you are maybe talking a little bit too much to the IT department here.
And they love it. I heard your IT department, so
we're
that's
get
good.
To that.
The Sanity platform is a content platform. Most commonly, you know them as CMSs. And we're trying to reinvent the CMS market. In short, CMSs comes from a place where they helped you build websites. They had it was a software for building a website. It got online, and there you go.
Okay, now, so one step back. So you're a company. You're Arctic, or you're EQT, or you're Boston Consulting Group, or any mom and pop shop, and you need to build a website.
Yep.
So that's the starting point. You need to build a website, and then you are using different tools to build this website, and you need to integrate, you need to integrate whatever databases and whatever you had into that web page. Is that the sort of stupid step back?
That's the base of it. And historically, there's been a super fragmented market. A lot of people have heard about Squarespace, where you can point and click and build it yourself. You will even manage that to do that, Gauta. Then you have WordPress, takes a little bit more. Then you have big, complicated systems like Adobe, et cetera. So it's a very fragmented market because, of course, it's a huge market. And
and these are the building blocks of the World Wide Web. Is that fair to say? Or it's because this is not a Python. This is not a Java. This is not a language.
These are applications.
These are applications.
These are monolith applications that historically you bought a license and you had to run them yourself. In more modern time, you buy them as SaaS applications. So basically they're hosted for you and you subscribe to them on a monthly basis. But anyhow, these are clunked together applications and predominantly supporting building websites. But of course, as we know, we're on a podcast now. You just looked at some apps on your phone. You know that content is everywhere. It isn't anymore a web page, website concern. And in that development, a lot of things are changing. You're changing the way organizations work, you're changing the priorities of what you want to, where you want to spend your money. You have large IT departments that were focusing on maintaining IT systems from Microsoft. And now you see more and more developers in every kind of companies that are working on building customer experiences because all your customer interaction moves online. So it's not any longer a question of a website tool, but a platform for treating the content for your customer communication, whatever medium that may be, an Alexa app, a pod, an in-store screen for ordering hamburgers or what have you. All of these things need content to power them, and you need to manage that content. And ideally, you want to manage that content with a red thread and with efficiency of moving forward and changing. And the tools you have for that, they're terrible.
How many customers do you have?
We have tens of thousands of people on our platform.
So
about
tens of thousands of users.
Tens of thousands of users and 1,000 paying customers.
That's quite a lot. That's
just to start.
That's just a start. So I checked with the Arctic Securities IT chief, Kjetil Martinsen. I asked him, I'm having a podcast with this guy, Magnus. He used to work here and he runs Sanity. And he says, and he, I would say, is a very unbiased, humble guy. He says, it's genius.
You save time on development resources and can use other capacities in the solution to build your database. It's a bit, little bit like an Excel spreadsheet that you can put anything in, like films, pictures, numbers, text, calculations, and then you can link this to APIs and scripts. That sounds pretty good, Magnus.
Thank you, Kjetil.
That was a good, good explanation.
I have a follow-up, though. Why is he not a paying customer?
Yeah, fantastic question. This is a topic I love, Gauta, because and one of the reasons I moved to San Francisco 2 years ago is some of the mentality around how do you build a software. There's a saying on Twitter that first-time founders are obsessed about product and second-time founders are obsessed about distribution. Well, I'm not a second-time founder, but maybe because I'm past 40, so you're getting older. We're obsessed about thinking about how do we spread this around the world? How do we get this out to a global market? We want to win this not by the biggest contracts, that also, but it starts by having the broadest distribution. Because if you really want a lot of people to convert the way they work with something, you need to touch a lot of people.
Is this a little bit like the old heroin saying, that you give away heroin for free and people get addicted? Is it Kjetil Martinsen?
Only partly, because what we're doing is actually we are fundamentally, truly giving away the software to a lot of people.
So Kjetil Martinsen gets some...
For 2 weeks.
He gets a simple sample for free.
And it's not a simple sample.
Okay.
It's maybe more like it's 80% of our software. So the thing is that, and this is, by the way, called product-led growth. And this is a movement that has been going on for years. It's pioneered by companies like Twilio and Stripe. And basically what you're doing is that you're giving away a certain portion of your software. Maybe you pay a little bit. Like most of the 1,000 people using Sanity pay very little also. So whether you pay $20 a month or zero, it doesn't, not really a big deal. And then we have customers paying us six and seven figure dollar contracts yearly. And the point is that the community you build around a software like this, if certain parameters are true, you can build a community around a software so that the larger the user base, the higher the value of the software that you're selling. That's what we are trying to do, because part of our software is open source. People could contribute back again, give plugins, etc. Them contributing to the software elevates the value of it. And of course, that's the first principle of building developer community. There's also good marketing.
Having a lot of users is always good. And especially if you have positive users and they maybe give you some hints and reply and they also help other users.
They also help other users. So we have a Slack community with about 15,000 registered developers. And we do some of the support there, but most of our non-paying customers get support from other people in the community. And this is a fundamental, I would say this is a fundamental product feature of what we're doing. But the interesting part is when you bring this over to marketing, because now we have some $1 million in turnover. We haven't called a single customer.
Have you disclosed how many $1 million in turnover? Or?
No, we haven't. Okay. I've disclosed that we roughly tripled it over the last 12 months, but we don't disclose exactly the number. But do you then
have this thing where you start off giving your product away for free and then you get people hooked and then do you add more and more features into the product? Is that, or does the customer become more and more dependent on the product?
So not really. You could think about it more like we've got three kinds of users. Those who just use it for free, and they could be in production and it could be a business, but it's a simpler use case. There's no support, no guaranteed support. There are a bunch of features that are not there. You start to get someone paying us a bit, could be $200 a month. They need some collaborative features that we're adding onto it. And then you get up to the enterprise section, which are mid-market and enterprises. They basically pay you for a lot for support, a lot for security, and other features. And when you want those kind of features, and this is typical for product-led growth companies, then you pay a substantial amount of money. And everybody understands that this is how the business works, but it's actually also a value for everyone across the value chain that would do it this way. It also creates an extremely efficient... It creates an extremely efficient so-called go-to-market model, because we're not calling a single customer. And we have customers like Burger King and Unilever, and they all come to us. And they typically see us through the attention that we get through the community. They see the tool, but they don't start using it for $100. We got that as well. I got Nike and Condé Nast paying us $200 a month. Not a big customer.
It sounds a little bit completely different, but it sounds a little bit like Kahoot. Because Kahoot, I've had Eilert Hanoa here on the podcast, and he has a billion users or a billion people that downloaded the app and played the Kahoot. And he's also a little bit frustrated, I may be allowed to say, sorry Eilert, that there's people that work for global organizations and they pay like a minimum to if you work for Coca-Cola or Nike or whatever, then you pay, $100, $1,000 to be able to play Kahoot for your closest. Yeah. And that's obviously showing the huge potential. But then you need to explain to me a little bit more, how do you then lift it up? I understand the service element, and so there's a bit, there's a product, there's a service, and there's a you get addicted to the product.
So it's more the security element of knowing that you have somewhere to go for support and what we call customer success, which is basically highly skilled engineers, some of the best we have, that really help our customers configure and integrate. We don't write their code. We don't do professional services. This is included. But you get that kind of support. And there are also features that you want to have, and certain feature for security. And of course, they're put there on enterprise because when big businesses use our software, they should pay us a fair price for the service. I wouldn't say I'm annoyed with people getting the software for free. I love them. And if we think companies that getting it for free should pay us, you need to not only look at the company, you need to look at what they use it for. And if you feel that people are using it for very valuable use cases that you should have gotten money for, well, then it's our job to hone that funnel, put the features to the right place, and put the structure to the right place so they would end up in the right place in the funnel. What we normally say, we love every customer that we have across this funnel, but we need to have them at the right place. And it's great what you say about Kahoot. Of course, Kahoot comes from the consumer angle.
Yeah.
And all these tactics, this way of building enterprise software businesses is borrowed from the consumer space.
Yeah, I think so too.
With the difference that in the consumer space, you want millions of people using your software, and then you want to monetize them a little bit and a little bit and a little bit.
Yeah, or you want to make the users the product. So you obviously sell marketing to...
True.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's another model. That's another model. True. That's more like the Facebook model. But if you want to monetize them a little bit, that's also a different model, because we don't want to do that. We're not trying to monetize these. We're not trying to monetize Arctic Securities. But if you're really going to use it for something really valuable with security, you would have to pay us a fair price. And then the model works. So this is more segmentation. That's why I say I can't subscribe fully to the drug selling model that you hinted to.
I think we need to go back a little bit, trip down memory lane. So first of all, what was Bangler?
Bangler. Bangler.
I was trying too hard on the American accent there.
That's okay. Bangler was an agency run by my three co-founders. They are fantastic, brilliant people.
And I have to say, they look like IT people.
They are. Well, they're actually a mix of movie people, IT people, and designers. They are these multi-talented people. Our CTO has even written an opera and that actually aired at the opera in Oslo.
Oh, wow.
So they're really multi-talented. And what they did, they worked in an intersection between technology and human interaction. And they made a lot of bespoke software for both Norwegian organizations like Amedia, etc., but also for international companies. And they always worked around content. And then in 2015, one of the most famous architects in the world, Rem Koolhaas, he engaged with them to build their new website. And of course, building just a website was too easy for my colleagues, for my co-founders. So they had to kind of reinvent how you built the website. And using modern technology, they found out that the content platform was a big pain. So they built their own 2015, and that's what later was reinvented again and led to Sanity, that we launched in 2017 by the end of the year.
Yeah, because where were you in 2015?
2015, I was still at EQT Partners doing private equity deals in the retail space, oil services, and I was very busy in engine cooling space with a Swedish company.
And did you code at night?
I did back then just start. You know, there was I was very curious about technology and what's happening. And if you look at it, this is the biggest step change in the global economy since the Industrial Revolution. And I felt EQT was fantastic, but I was quite far away from that technology change. By this time, EQT already hired a couple of people from Google and Spotify, brilliant people in the IT digital team, and started talking to them. And I stumbled upon neural networks, artificial intelligence, around that time. And I was triggered by a person who didn't want to explain to me what a neural network was, because they say it's a black box.
Or it's too difficult for you, my son.
It's too difficult. It's beneath me to tell you. So I went home and I Googled. One of the first results I found was like how to build a neural network in 10 lines of Python. So I had to Google what is Python. And Python is a programming language that is very very much used by artificial intelligence and quite helpful for people who come from from business, I think, that, you know, the segue from Excel, which has been my tool for, I don't know, 15 years, to Python is a different dimension because it's text downward, but it isn't that big a jump.
It's building macros, effectively.
It's a little bit the same. And I got hooked. It's fantastic. And started exploring and building new things. And eventually told my wife I was not going to work for 2 years and figure out more IT and build my own company. Didn't really have an idea what that was, but
it sounds like you were quite lucky because you met these guys from Bangalore and they certainly had something really good going for them. Did they have any sales at the time?
So Bangalore back then was still an agency. But they were focusing a lot of their time around the product Sanity that was about to launch. They had a couple of customers like Amedia. We're doing work for MIT, Office of Metropolitan Architecture, where we pioneered it, and DSR in New York. So, and also with the Mellon Foundation, quite international, a lot of US focus, but there was no commercial plan around Sanity, the company or the product, which is very much where I came into this partnership that with my co-founders that we started January 2018. And the first thing we did was to shut down the agency, because I think it's extremely hard. One of the most important things when you build a company, I think, is to have focus, to really, really focus.
Know what you're good at.
Know what you're good at. Know what really builds you forward for the vision that you're having.
Know like, how you help your clients. Know what where you make a difference.
Which clients do you want? Because there are a lot of clients you don't want. And I tell a lot of other founders that I support and do some sparring with, that you really need to take the destiny in your own hands. It's actually not that hard, especially as a co-founder, to sell a good software in the beginning, just to get the money. But getting the money isn't necessarily the proof of what people call product market fit. When you get product market fit, it's more that people pull it out of your hands. And that's a significantly different thing than if you have to sell. And back to product-led growth, if you really get a product market fit where people pull it out of your hands, that's when you could build multi-billion dollar companies. If you have to start pushing it and shoving it down people's organizations, then you have a very different dynamic if you're going to be successful at doing a multi-billion dollar company from that. It's not impossible, but it is quite a different dynamic.
We are jumping a little bit because there is a press release out on August 14th, 2019, saying Heavybit welcomes new member Sanity. Mm-hmm. So, Magnus, what on earth is Heavybit?
Heavybit is an accelerator/venture fund started by a legendary founder called James Lindenbaum, who founded a company called Heroku way back when. It was the first company that really brought hosting to the cloud around what was called Ruby on Rails, technical thing. But he built a company that really took off.
Is this sort of Stanford University alumni sort of area? Well, it's Silicon Valley, right?
I don't even know, actually. Okay. One of the founders is James with Heroku. The other one is one of the first known engineers around AWS. And James sold off Heroku to Salesforce, but he then started investing in other companies. And he focuses his investments around developer tools.
It's a quite small fund.
It's a very small fund if you compare it to EQT, where I used to work. They have less than $100 million per fund. I don't know if they announced their latest fund, so I shouldn't say the number. But they are small because they go in typically on a pre-Series A stage. So typically, and these numbers are, a lot is changing in the venture funding world because these rounds are getting larger. When we did our seed, it was $2.4 million. We had a pre-seed of $1 million that we did in Norway, as you know.
Full disclosure, I was part of that when I was working at Nordea, back when then, or whatever you say. Yeah. So this is your first sort of serious fundraising with a US investor. And how was it, did people applaud your sort of relocation to the US, or how?
Of course, all the Americans did, because they thought that was the only right thing to do, to move over to Silicon Valley and be closer. There were some Norwegians, including yourself, that asked me, Magnus, why are you going to go over there for? Like, what's this Series A bullshit you're talking about you're going to do? I think you said exactly that.
I felt it. Some people go places on holiday. And I actually went on holiday to Silicon Valley for a week in 2016. And I came back, you know, with a lot of enthusiasm. And I felt that sometimes you meet people that go places and, oh, it's so nice I'm staying. But I obviously was wrong. So I apologize on air for that.
There's everybody has to decide how they try to build their own company. It was always clear for me that we belonged in the US and we had to move to the US because of the way we go to market, number one, and the type of company we are. The developer businesses are quite common in the US. Because imagine all the businesses, we're rebuilding the world in a digital sense, in a virtual sense. Imagine all the services that you need. The value of these businesses are getting significant. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. This is something that has happened over the last decade. So there are many people, among them James Lindenbaum, who's not only been doing it himself, but has been advising other people like Stripe and PagerDuty and CircleCI and other successful developer-centric companies in the US. So we knew... We got to know Hevibit via a company called Mux, just became a unicorn. The CEO there is also an investor in Sanity and partly Norwegian, I think he is, John Dahl. He introduced us and it didn't take long before we understood that these people really understand what it takes to build a successful company in this space.
I don't blame you for needing to go a little bit outside Oslo to find people who really understand what you're doing. Because it's in fairness, right? We're a relatively small village and there's not that many, well, tech companies and not that many, I would say, B2B tech companies. And I think there's several reasons to applaud. And then how was Hevibit instrumental in helping you with the Series A where you got hold of Threshold?
100%. Hevibit was, we also in that round got in Alliance Venture from Oslo. There's been very supportive and have other different kind of experience. And it's clear when you have someone like Hevibit who knows exactly and has seen this multiple times before, they can point at things and they do all the time, both going up to the Series A. What do you need to do? Because in Norway, I think it's less of a structure around a Series A market. It doesn't exist necessarily
We need to touch upon that a little bit. So what is the difference between a Series A and what we in Norway call whatever, a rights issue or a new issue or a directed new issue? Or I mean, what is the difference between sort of the plain vanilla equity story here and, you know, the Series A?
So Series A is a convertible, it's a preference share that has certain rights, and those rights are pretty standard. When you do one of those deals, there are certain elements you may negotiate, but it's pretty clear for everyone what is expected. It is also very clear for everyone what is expected of the company. What stage should you be at? It could take different shapes. Do you need revenue? Don't you need revenue? But there are certain things you know investors look at, and there are funds that specialize at looking at this. So Josh Stein at Threshold, former DFJ, he specializes at coming in at this stage. He knows exactly the risks that he should look for, the maturity that he likes to see, the development he likes to see in how you go to market, in the organization, etc.
And this is this
and he
is,
repeats that over and over.
This is 2020. You're doing the Series A in 2020.
We did the Series A and we signed the term sheet in 6th of May 2020, which was probably the worst timing in maybe a decade in Silicon Valley. That was painful.
And this, you had some revenue then? So this was like you crossed that, you were not a pre-revenue company.
We had a couple of $1 million of revenue.
Exactly. And this guy, did you ever work with him, by the way? I see on his CV he used to be with the Boston Consulting Group, but there was no.
I did never. He was he's 5 years older than me. So we never did, and we didn't really bond as much around the Boston Consulting Group either. It was interesting. I didn't meet him in person before I think late fall 2020. But We bonded a lot from my side around his way of thinking the investor role. I think good venture capitalists that I've met over the last couple of years have a very, very precise view of their corporate governance and what their role should be in a company. And they've been extremely supportive, much less pushy than many people think these American investors are. They're just extremely supportive. But they do help me look around the corners, and I seek their advice a lot to see what may we be missing? What's coming 18 months down the road that we haven't seen yet that we need to prepare for? And how do we meet people to prepare for that?
Generally speaking, what's the most important thing for a Series A investor? Because we have this thing...
Product market fit.
Yeah, but then also, does he think about his exit already? Or how long can a Series A investor wait until there is a, you know, until he sells? Does he sell in Series B or no?
This in the true Silicon Valley venture capitalist, they think about exit in terms of how big a company could become and not in terms of thinking about when they should exit. So these are funds that go that have long, long lifetimes and don't expect their money back, because their best success stories are the companies that keep on going and keep on going.
But do they then follow up in the Series B and C?
Yeah, they do. So they typically Josh invested in our B. So Iconic led our B. Fantastic new investor we got in our Series B round.
This is happening now on the end of June 2021. So a year and a bit after the Series A, you do your Series B.
Yep.
And then I'm obliged to ask, obviously, if you can comment on... So you did $39 million of Series B?
$39 million.
And how big part of the company did you have to give away then?
We don't disclose that, but it was actually less than I expected when we went into the round. We had a bit of a harder...
So the big picture, is it like 2x up from Series A, or is it typically sort of objective?
I think typically investors would expect you to be at least 2-3 times up from the A.
Because if not,
it obviously doesn't really matter, but it matters for the funds, because they mark up their books and they're going to raise a new fund way before they exit. So I think if you do less than 2.5 is not great. We did more than that, but
I looked on the homepage of Iconic Capital. They have a beautiful slogan. Do you know what it is?
I actually don't.
It's, we are a privately held investment firm dedicated to improving the world by channeling capital, talent, and ideas to initiatives that advance society. Amen. But, so how do you feel that Sanity fits into the initiatives that advance society?
I think we do. I think we help businesses build more revenue through better digital approaches. And
That's good.
We reinvent that. And I think making the world a better place is multifaceted. Having lived in the US for a couple of years, you get a lot of respect for some of the things we read about in Norwegian newspapers, but you get closer to in the US, it comes to especially how the tech industry is taking social responsibility. So I think we have a part of being a good citizen in that way and making the world a better place. I think if we get rid of these old CMSs, we're going to make the world a better place.
More efficient.
Much more efficient. Oh. We're going to give customers much better digital experiences. But of course, that may not be a noble case, but we are targeting to reinvent a multi-billion dollar space.
This guy, Doug Pepper, he's the main guy, I believe, at Iconic Capital.
Yeah, Doug is one of the five main partners at Iconic Capital.
So he has this thing, I Googled him, and he has this thing where he says, technology matters, strategy matters, but people matters most.
Yep, he's very people-centric, and Doug and I spend a lot of time. This time, opposed to our Series A, the Series A took us 3-4 months, and we had a few term sheets. Honestly, we had one. It was Josh, but that turned out to be fantastic. But this time we had a lot of interest. We had more than 50 VCs calling us and wanted to take a look at the company before we started a round. We went out to around roughly 10 of them, and a lot of them were very interested. We got multiple term sheets and try to spend a lot of time figuring out what does the best investor look like? Because I've never done this before. Right? It's my first time for all of this. But it really comes down to how they think about when they're investing and how they think about supporting the company long term. And Doug is really a calm, experienced investor and a people person. He takes some fundamental bets that he believes in, and then he tries to support. I had my first board meeting actually with Doug and the rest of the board yesterday, where we already show this trust in us as founders to make good decisions. And the angle not of control, but of support and trying to help us figure out the right steps.
But there's a bit of a paradox there, I guess, with technology helping the world moving fast forward, and it's, you know, artificial intelligence, it's eating the world, and well, software is eating the world and artificial intelligence is eating everything. But then again, we're down to human beings who needs to, I mean, these venture capitalists, you know, the masters of the world, they need to find the right human beings to help us all make the world a better place. So... did you change it anyway after you moved to America? Did you change your habits? Are you still putting a lot of Swedish Match products up your nose?
I changed some habits. I was already not the biggest social media fan. I spent time on Twitter and LinkedIn, but I was on Facebook for a very brief period of time. Now I deleted all my Facebook products. I actually have a little personal ban on Amazon. I don't think that is a model that helps society. I see people love it. And especially after I moved to the US, I saw how dependent people were on this instant delivery. And you read, I'm married to a journalist, so we talk a lot about these kind of issues in society. And you look at all the challenges that business model imposes, both on workers and on the supply chain and on competition. And we chose that we don't want to be part of that. We also did some other smaller kind of inspired maybe more by my Norwegian friends than my American friends, but I started intermittent fasting. So I don't eat after 6 o'clock in the evening and I don't eat before 10 o'clock in the morning. And
that helps you? You think that's good?
I think that gives me a lot more energy. I used to be a nice person. So I used to sit up, you know, easily working until 2-3 in the morning. I think when I worked here, it was even worse. Even better. You always said that. Yeah? Work hard, play hard. But I've been sleeping on the couch on the 9th floor here multiple times.
Some of the most depressed people I know have too much spare time.
You should read Why We Sleep. I read that actually by the time I moved over. And I realized a couple of things. So
it's a good book. It's a little bit too long, but I agree.
Yeah, but you don't have to read all of it. You got the point after a third of the book. That's like every book. You don't really have to read all the books. That's more for amusement or for enjoyment. But the first third of it, it's actually interesting how you read books. I tried once to do, you know, the trick about reading the last two pages of each chapter, because no author could resist summarizing the chapter on those last two pages. I think Why We Sleep is a book I read that way.
Yeah, I think you could do that. And I think obviously that sleep is important. And obviously as you go older, maybe it gets even more important. And as you also may focus less on maybe more mundane tasks and more on sort of high level strategic tasks, then you obviously need to be sharp when you do those
decisions. Especially when you're gonna help other people do amazing things. And a CEO, I've never been a CEO before. And never had direct personal responsibility before. But
how many people do you have now?
50.
50 people.
A little less than 50, but yeah.
But you are not stopping there.
Oh, no. Our next blueprint is 200. And we won't be stopping there, but we kind of take it in batches and try to find the breaking points. So when you go past, Andreas at Ottobo was the first one to tell me this, you need to find these breaking points in the organization. And around 50, there will be one. And I clearly see that now because you need more. You need more management and you need more structure. There was another one earlier that we faced, but these breaking points make us kind of rethink. And that was part of the reason we took on money now, because we didn't need the money. We had a lot of money in the bank, but we need the money eventually. But we saw this next step of our journey, which is building an organization that becomes more powerful, 200 people. We do these things on the product. We do these things on marketing and sales. And we do these things on the leadership and the organization and the support sides. And that's really where we are now. So building an organization in 120 kilometers an hour that is supposed to be sustainable, where every job changes in 6 and 12 months, and you're going to find people who fit and thrive and enjoy working there with a balance, not working their butts off, because we don't run an investment banking style of working at Sanity. I don't believe that's the best model for creative people who's going to find the best solution for software and other things. So we run a different culture, but we need to find these breaking points. And now we're hiring a bunch of leaders. So we just hired an engineering manager out of Atlassian. For those who don't know Atlassian, that's a really iconic software company out of Australia that's been growing 30% forever. And it just keeps on going 30%. They pioneered some of these inbound motions that we don't call customers, etc.
But then I have to ask, you know, you're Norwegian and your wife is even a Norwegian journalist. So when you see all these Euronext Growth IPOs, I mean, there's been, I think, 80 or 90 last 12 months. And don't you feel tempted to just, you know, I guess, be even more in the limelight and, you know, ring that bell and you ring that artificial bell on the Euronext Growth and, you know, continue to run your company from Silicon Valley, but be like an Oslo listed thing?
Not at all. I have deep respect for the people who do it. And I know multiple of the CEOs who have Euronext Growth companies. Actually, one of my best friends IPO'd in Stockholm today with OX2, the wind company. That was a bigger IPO. But no, why would we? I never really discussed with someone. I participated in some of them. I shareholder in some of these Euronext Growth companies. But to me, it doesn't. We don't need. I have no interest in telling you what the company's worth or showing anyone what we built. I think that's a private matter for a company like us. I think our business should focus on some very few things, and we do that better in the private than in the public. But of course, we have access to this kind of capital, these kind of investors. We closed our funding round in 14 days, or we had a term sheet signed in 14 days since we started calling people. So for us getting capital, I've never seen that as an issue. I was doubting a little bit during Corona, but it has never been an issue. And also, we're not going to sell out of this company. We're not looking for exit. We're looking, and our investors are the same way. We're looking to build a very substantial company that could stand on its own feet. There are a lot of companies, a lot of founders want to build something to sell it off.
Well, and you could also argue that the reason why we have this Euronext Growth, and in Sweden you have Spotlight and First North, is maybe because we don't have the same venture capital ecosystem, right? So you have people that at some point earlier will need liquidity or perceived or potential.
I think that's a significant part of it. I think also there are the US is big, vast. So some of the companies that really want to become big, those are the ones we're talking about in a company with 300 million, a lot of immigrants coming in to build software companies and other kind of companies. In Norway, of course, being a small country, you don't have that mass of companies that want to stay private and build for long. But you see companies like Colonial is a good example, taking on more money in the private market. And SoftBank is famous for keeping companies off the stock exchange, right? And building them. So what's the point of an IPO? I was part of IPOing XXL, when I was at EQT. So that was fun. I tell my colleagues, we have to be prepared to be a listed company one day, because I think that's when you really grow up, or we at least need to have the stability and the size to do that. But that's at least 4 or 5 years down the road, and it'll be in the US and not in Norway, because I believe we can.
Rounding off with a quick Q&A, and I don't want to make this too Arctic-centric, even though obviously we're proud to have you as an alumni. So I've found three bosses that you may or may not have dealt with directly. But looking at your CV, you used to be at the Boston Consulting Group. There was a famous head of the Oslo office called Adam Ekdal. You worked at Arctic Securities. There was, still is, the founder CEO, Mats Iversen. And you were at EQT, where the CEO now, I'm sure he was head of something then, is Kristian Sinding. So, quick answer, who was the best boss?
Christian.
Christian Sinding was the best boss. Why? Quick answer.
You really managed to build a vision of building something really large, and he does it in an impressive way.
Who of these three guys were the best enlightener of the entrepreneur inside Magnus Hylestad?
Still Christian. He's a risk taker, and I learned to take risk from Christian and Anders Misen.
Who of these three guys would be the best guy to have a beer with?
Adam Ekdal. He's such fun.
He actually owns a bar, or at least half of a...
Maybe he owns it still, but when I was at BCG, we went to this football tournaments down in Greece and Spain, and it was hilarious. And Adam was there, and he was always the captain on the team, scoring the most goals. And I was a goalie, because I'm not that good in football. And he always cheered me up, and you're doing good, until there was a penalty shootout. Then he comes, move out of the way, Magnus, I'll take this.
And if you were a young Magnus and you looked at these three impressive CEOs, who would you take personal advice from?
Christian.
And who would you have guessed would have been the richest of these three guys?
Christian.
A little bit too many Christian answers, but I'm sorry about that. We have the last question of the day. You can answer anything you like, but it's sort of a very neutral question. What was the best part of working for Arctic Securities back when?
I think that was understanding the balance between the numbers and the opportunity in the company. And one of the things I remember the most is Bjørn Løvenskiold. I learned a lot from especially I worked a lot with Bjørn Løvenskiold and Petter Bakken.
He's a very hardworking head of corporate finance, incredibly steady, hardworking, solid.
And very balanced and very smart. And he told me how to start assessing a great company. And what defines a great company, something that I later learned more about at EQT, which is really what EQT is known for. And it's not a coincidence that Bjorn works a lot with EQT. But you can't just look at a balance sheet and a statement to figure out whether it's a great company. You also have to do that, but you really need to understand the dynamics and look into the glass bowl of how a company would be further down the road.
And my interpretation is, of course, that what Magnus says here is that the best part of working with Arctic was all the great people at Arctic.
we had a lot of fun as well. Arctic was, I liked, the entrepreneurial spirit as well was also very cool and you probably experienced this a couple of times, I remember when I asked Mats at some point about recruiting, because I thought we should be more present. All the London investment banks were present at Handelshøyskolen, where we both studied, and the big consultancy firms. And I stuck my head into Mats' office, and I asked him if we could consider having a strategy for recruiting and having summer internships. And he said, sounds great, go do that.
Yeah,
that was all he said.
And a little bit like this podcast. I asked Matt Severson, so maybe you should do a podcast. He said, yeah, you should do it. So it's a little bit how things were.
And I think it was in a good way, because I think he just trusted my eagerness to do something. And he probably assumed that he would catch it before I fucked it up. And we didn't. We hired summer interns. We had a lot of other colleagues coming in, joining in to kind of build that recruiting motion that I think was pretty good for Arctic. I think you still do it.
We did. Magnus Hillestad, thank you very much for spreading your energy in the Arctic podcast studio. We're back next week with another exciting guest, but maybe not as American as Magnus, but thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast has been prepared by Arctic for information purposes only. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional advice. The information provided in this podcast is not intended to constitute investment advice, nor is the information intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase or sale of any financial instrument. Relevant and specific professional advice should always be obtained before making any investment or credit decision. It is important to note that past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast does not fulfill the criteria for preparing investment research and must be seen as marketing material. All information submitted during this podcast is obtained from public sources that Arctic believes to be reliable, but which Arctic has not independently verified. Arctic makes no guarantee, representation, or warranty as to its accuracy or completeness. No liability whatsoever is accepted for any direct or indirect, including consequential, loss or expense arising from the use of information from this podcast.